you all for coming today. My name is Elizabeth McNamee, and I'm going to speak with you about the soil-water characteristic curve, field capacity, and how these important soil parameters influence our model predictions of N2O. I want to extend a thank you to my collaborators, and also mention that this was funded by the USDA by a NEPA grant. So nitrous oxide is an extremely potent greenhouse gas with almost 300 times the global warming potential of CO2. And the majority of our N2O emissions in the U.S. are from agriculture. Now, over half of those are from our soil management. So it's important that we understand what's leading to nitrous oxide emissions. And this happens through two processes, denitrification and nitrification. But the challenge here is that these processes are influenced by complex interactions of environmental drivers, including soil water, which is highly spatially and temporally variable, making them difficult to measure and predict. And since we can't be everywhere at the same time measuring N2O, that's why we turn to models. So one frequently used model for N2O emissions is the Descent model. This is the daily time step of the Century model, and it's a biogeochemical process-based model that simulates soil organic matter, plant nutrient cycling, and nitrous oxide emissions with changes in land cover and changes in climate. And what I really want to highlight here is the importance of soil water in this model, which I've highlighted in blue, and how it affects all of the other processes that are happening in the model. More specifically, Descent simulates N2O using a leaky pipe model, and there are soil parameters that influence the amount of nitrous oxide emissions that are simulated. That includes gas diffusivity, which is influenced by the bulk density and field capacity, and also the water-filled pore space. Now, the denitrification mechanism is triggered in Descent once water-filled pore space exceeds 55%. Now, at the core of this research is the soil-water characteristic curve, so I just wanted to do this as a refresher. Or maybe it's new, but this curve is the relationship between two fundamental soil properties. We have volumetric soil water content on the y-axis, and then matrix suction or tension on the x-axis. And that is essentially a measure of how tightly the soil is holding on to water. And we see that the relationship between these two parameters changes depending on the texture or the structure of the soil. And this relationship is really important for estimating hydraulic conductivity, mass and transport flow, and also the water status of the soil. So now that we've looked at the modeling background of Descent and this soil water piece, the objectives of this research were to look at different soil water characteristic curve measurements, see what these mean for the parameters that are plugged into the Descent model, how Descent then predicts the soil water content, and finally what this means for our N2O emission estimates. So first, we investigated differences between laboratory and in situ measurements of the soil water characteristic curve, and the last three steps were ways of evaluating what these differences mean in downstream applications. So as far as methods, our in situ soil water characteristic curves were constructed with volumetric water content measurements using water content probes, and matrix suction was measured using tensiometers. And data to construct the curves was paired over time during dry down periods. This was all done on a silt loam soil in Arlington, Wisconsin, and in the corn phase of a corn-soy rotation. The laboratory measurements were done using the evaporation method in the wet end of the curve, which is primarily what we're interested in here. And in this method, an undisturbed soil core is taken, wet up gradually from the bottom, so air is allowed to escape or able to escape through the top of the core, and then water content and tension measurements are taken over time as the soil core dries out. So jumping right into the results here, we see that the lab soil water characteristic curves indicated in orange here report larger water contents at every matrix suction that was recorded compared to our field measurements. And sometimes this is as much as by 20% water content increase. So we're seeing this huge difference in the soil water characteristic curve depending on how we measure it. And we have some hypotheses about why this is. This isn't necessarily new in the literature. However, this difference is really stark. And some of that can be attributed to hysteresis. And also, we think that air entrapment may explain this. So in the laboratory core, air was able to escape, as I mentioned, through the top of the core, and it was fully saturated, whereas that wasn't necessarily the condition in the field. And it, the field soils may have looked more like this picture on the left. So now we've seen these differences in the water characteristic curve, and now I'm going to take you through how we evaluated what these differences mean in our model predictions. So first we ran DASENT with field capacity numbers derived from these in situ and laboratory measurements, then compared simulated and observed water contents, and finally looked at the N2O emissions. So field capacity was assumed to be the water content at 33 kilopascals. So I've drawn this green line here indicating that, and I pulled out a range of field capacities from the laboratory and in situ measurements, resulting in four different field capacities that we ran the models with. So 23 and 24% for in situ, and 28 and 32% for laboratory. I also want to mention that we did run the models with three different bulk densities, because bulk density also affects the porosity in the soil, which has an effect on nitrous oxide emissions. And so that made for a total of 12 model runs. So here we have the first results of this shows the observed water contents throughout the growing season along with the predicted water contents by DASENT. I've only included one of the in-situ field capacity model runs on the top here because the results were so similar. And bulk density is included in each of these graphs. So right off the bat, we can see that bulk density doesn't seem to have an effect within the same field capacities, with the exception of some of these more extreme precipitation events. However, when an in-situ field capacity is used, DASENT tends to underpredict the soil water contents, as we see in the top graph. And when a larger lab-derived field capacity is used, DASENT is showing a closer prediction with our observed soil moisture values. However, also tends to overpredict during certain events. So we can look at this another way. Here we have observed water content on the x-axis and simulated on the y for each of our model runs. And I've included the bold one-to-one line here because if the points were clustered around this line, that would indicate that DASENT was doing a good job of predicting the observed water content. And so we see, again, for our in-situ derived field capacities, DASENT underpredicts. And then when we use the lab-derived field capacity, it both over and under predicts. All of the slopes here were significantly different from one, and intercepts were different from zero, indicating that there wasn't a systematic bias going on in the model, just shifting the predicted water contents in one way or another. So what this means for our N2O predictions is that when we use the lab-derived field capacity, we ended up with N2O, cumulative N2O emissions that were more than double in some cases what was predicted using in-situ field capacity. And this difference in N2O emissions increased as bulk density increased. And so this resulted in 1.7 to 2.3 times more N2O emissions. And we tried to think mechanistically about what might be going on in the DASENT model to lead to this stark difference and came up with two hypotheses. The first, both of them involve this entrapped air that I mentioned previously. The first, however, has to do with the actual field capacity that's estimated. So if DASEN is triggering denitrification when water-filled pore space exceeds 55%, and a larger field capacity measurement is used, such as the lab, then water-filled pore space exceeds 55% more often. I've drawn this in a schematic here. So here we have the 55% water-filled pore space, and if you look at the orange line of soil moisture over the growing season, you see that this is exceeding the 55% threshold more frequently, leading to more time in denitrification conditions, which means that DASEN could be overestimating denitrification. Alternatively, another hypothesis involves this trapped air and active porosity. So if we think of natural field conditions and consider pores with trapped air as inactive porosity, then the water-filled pore space in DASEN is calculated on both these active and inactive pores based on the total pore space. However, then the water-filled pore space is based on all of these pores the exceeding of the 55% threshold occurs less frequently than if water-filled pore space was based only on the active pores, meaning that DASEN is modeling with less time in denitrification conditions and could be underestimating denitrification. So overall, we've seen that the soil water characteristic curve plays an important role in our model predictions. We saw that there were different soil water characteristic curve measurements depending on if we measured the curve in the lab or the field. When we apply this plug-in parameters from these measurements to DASEN, we end up with different predictions of soil water content, which down the road affects our N2O emissions estimates. Now, there are a couple things I should mention here. The concept of field capacity is inherently vague. 33 kilopascals is taken as the normal field capacity value for a silt loam soil. And air entrapment is not accounted for in the model processes. And so DASEN could be getting the right answers for the wrong reasons. Overall, DASEN is doing, I think, an excellent job of predicting a very complicated process. However, we need to make sure that the predictions are based on true relationships and simulating what's really happening in the field as our climate continues to change and when we want to alter our management practices. So for future research, I think it's important that we incorporate these differences in lab and field soil water characteristic curves into our models. Try to find a way to account for true field conditions, and this may mean elaborating on the soil water portion of our models. And this is especially important in the context of complex soil water flow dynamics that affect so many of our natural processes. Thank you. I'll take questions. When we measured our soil water characteristic curves, we did not cover the surface.
Normally, we saturated the field first, then they covered it.
Right. We were trying to, I realized that, and we thought it was beneficial to monitor what's actually happening in the field. So if the soil isn't fully saturated throughout the growing season, then that's what we're trying to model, I guess.
As for your lab measurements, so you need the WP4 and evaporation measure. Which measure is
Is more what?
You are more confident.
Okay, so the question is which method for the laboratory methods is better, I guess. And I'd say that you actually need them both together. The WP4C is the dew point potentiometer method, and that measures the dry end of the curve, and you need to couple that with the high prop in the wet end. Not that I know of. So that's a big thing. Macropores aren't accounted for in the model, and neither is preferential flow. So some of those really high water contents that Dasent modeled, that's because it's essentially filling up one layer of the soil, and then water moves down into the next layer, whereas the measurements that we took at all different depths after an intense rain event, we had water content spiking at 70 centimeters. So it's not accounting for the way that water is distributed in the soil profile